Hello and welcome everyone to a marginally somewhat special episode of MTG Potpourri. Because again, apparently Conley actually died, because we can not even his ghost will appear on this podcast. So joining me is Adam.
I'm a big boy, sure, but I don't believe I actually count as three people.
Yeah, so it's another two-man podcast, and we're recording at night, and Adam, I sent you an email. I am tempted to try a lunchtime podcast at some point. I'm just curious how it would go. So it seems like it could potentially just be crash and burn, or it could just be awesome, because it's the middle of the day, you know, you're doing well, we're not tired yet, you're still doing work stuff, it might be good. But Adam, you basically played Magic for, what, four straight days, if I was understanding from your Twitter feed correctly.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it wasn't like Grand Prix 10-hour stretch style playing, but I fit some in. I was at PAX Prime, PAX Penny Arcade Expo. It's a big gaming convention in Seattle, happens every year. So I basically took a week. I arrived early and left late and kind of wrapped the week with hanging out with some Wizards guys over lunch, meeting up with a bunch of friends that I have in Seattle, and then, of course, attending PAX itself proper, going to the Magic Party for Cons of Tarkir, going to the World Building panel, the whole nine yards of Magic. I did it all.
So for PAX Prime, was the original PAX? Is they have PAXs in Texas all over the place now?
Yeah, so the two guys that run PAX are based out of or close to Seattle. And so PAX Prime has been going on. This is their 10th year of running the convention. And to give you a sense of that, I mean, that was only 2004 was the first one. Gen Con has been running like 45 years. So PAX is relatively new in terms of conventions, but it's kind of built up very quickly a big gaming reputation. The entire Washington Convention Center and several theaters and hotels nearby get taken over for the convention now. And
yeah, it's kind of this huge conglomeration. Basically, I think a lot of people get PAX and think of video games, but it's video games, board games, just a shitload of Magic announcements happen at PAX Prime.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting group. When I was there 2 years ago, it definitely felt like video games with some Magic thrown on. Mayfair had a booth. Fantasy Flight Games wasn't there 2 years ago, as far as I remember. If they were, they were so diminished, I don't remember. This year, it's really seemed to grow. It's still video games first. So, like, you know, 2K's upcoming release, Evolve, was like the big talk of the show, and everybody wanted to play it, and the critics are going nuts for it, and like the lines capped. Like, you have to queue for everything at PAX. That's kind of the joke, and I hate queues. So obviously I did like as little to no queuing as I humanly could at PAX, which means I only queued like a half dozen times,
You mean a line, right?
Yeah, a queue is a line, where you wait, and effectively you're just a number, and you just wait for your number to come up. So like the Evolve queue was constantly capped. But the things that are around it have kind of really grown up. There was a retailer that was selling, you know, the whole bunch of like nerdy type t-shirts and like plushies of different like meme type characters and things like that. But it also had a fairly diverse board game selection. Mayfair had a pretty good booth that basically looked like a stripped down miniaturized version of what they were doing at Gen Con. And I demoed one of the games. I didn't get a chance to demo Villainy. Kind of a complicated, a lot of moving pieces, but they all flow. Like once you get how it works, it just comes together. I wouldn't call it intuitive by any stretch. Definitely very rulesy, but you basically play like a villain hiring henchmen, and you try to defeat Phantastaman, you know, the generic hero type of the city. There's a bunch of qualifiers you got to jump through to do that. Fantasy Flight Games was doing a bunch of organized play and had some tournaments. Cascade Games was back again doing their big Magic stuff with the prize wall and kind of showing that off. There was events basically scheduled like every hour, so like any given hour PAX was open, you could be registering for an event. Plus there were on-demand events, and they had the Wizards area took over more space, and so there's like a dedicated room for free play, and there's maybe I want to say like maybe room for like 40-ish people, 60-ish people maybe in the room. And towards the end of every day at PAX, it would get filled with Magic players and a lot of board gamers. I was really surprised to see how many how many board games were out. People were playing, like, I played a game of Hanabi, like, on the floor in one of the open areas. Like, literally, we all sat on the floor in a corner and played this game. I didn't like it very much. It's a little werewolf-esque, but I had some interesting things going on with it. But yeah, it was just, it's very gamey, much more than I remember 2 years ago.
So you said you're there the whole weekend, you know, get together with Wizards people. You mentioned that, and we were talking before, is that there was a big, and we're going to call it a cons party, but then also a couple of panels.
Yeah, they, I mean, they every PAX, it seems, for the past like 5 or 6 years since Zendikar, they've had a party where they reveal a whole bunch of cards, and you've got to like basically complete some puzzles. They kind of throttle the tickets that they give out for it. And you come to the party, and there's free food, and I don't know if there's, I'm not sure if there are free drinks. If you're in the media, or you're like you have you're like a personality, or I honestly don't know. That didn't seem like there was a system to it. But I got pulled in as a VIP, so I didn't have to complete the puzzle, but I got to go, and in the VIP area, the drinks are free, so I've never had to pay. But it's just a big celebration. They'll put up a whole bunch of the cards up front, and so like I took pictures and shared those. And apparently, between Mark Rosewater and I, we made the hashtag trend in the United States. That was a thing, I guess, for like a minute or something. But it's basically just like it is a literal party. Like the music is so loud, you have to like shout at the people standing next to you. It gets really packed early on because like everybody wants to come in, and everybody like. Again, you queue for food, you gotta get in line again. So you stand in line like an hour and a half to get into the party, just to stand in line to eat something. This year they kind of space some things out. So typically they've put all the spoilers out right away. So like if they're showing a Planeswalker or they're showing off Shocklands or stuff like that, it's all up front right away. You just see it right away. This year they spaced it out. So they teased that there's going to be like, you know, rewards for sticking with the party. And the first one they did is they shared the new Sarkon, the new Planeswalker, which was really cool because, they showed the trailer first. And in the trailer, they showed Sarkon at the end of it turning into like a dragon and taking off flying, which is, you know, obviously a very intentional thing. Like none of the Sarkons we've seen turn into dragons. Oh, the new Sarkon, his ability lets him turn into a dragon. I get it. And at the end of the show, they shared that the allied fetch lands from Onslaught were being reprinted. And that was a big to-do as well.
So I guess tell me more about the party part of this. Is that later in the day, I can, you know, I can watch panels. I can look at the preview cards. I guess I don't know, you mentioned puzzles, and I saw you put up in your tree that you had a custom bear token made. Like, what else do you do during this party?
It's really
are people making out like magic bleachers. Like, what kind of party is this?
I didn't see any making out. Although the alcohol was flowing very freely, so by the end of the night, it's like most parties. There's the sober people and the drunk people, and there's kind of a very big gap in between. And it was literally like a party. They had DJ'd music, and people were really dancing and getting into it. They opened up, like, you could get into a queue, and you could have your photo taken punching the bear. So when they first teased Khans of Tarkir, and they showed the art at the Pro Tour of the one dude punching a bear, I don't know if you remember that, but, like, bear punch was, like, a thing. You could get a token taken of you punching the bear if you wanted. Which is obviously really sweet because who doesn't want to punch a bear? But it's really a celebration. Like the people that take the time at PAX to dedicate themselves to getting into the queue right away, because you gotta go to the magic booth right away, right? Because you gotta get in early on Friday or Saturday. There's only 2 days that you can possibly get a pass for the party. You gotta complete all the puzzles. And then you've got to go line up to get inside. So the people that do this are typically Magic's dedicated fans. Like, this isn't a party where, like, so some people gave the San Diego Comic-Con promos a lot of flack. Because it's like, who are these people? They don't even know Magic. You know, screw those people. I want my cool stuff for me because I'm the coolest Magic person ever. Well, if you're at PAX and you think Magic is the coolest thing ever, you can almost certainly get an invite to this party. where it is literally filled with people who love magic. So floating all around the room, like, you could run into Marshall Sutcliffe, a bunch of Wizards folks like Aaron Forsythe is there, Mark Rosewater, Sean Main. Like, I got a chance to talk to all of them. Brian Kibler came in at one point. And then there's a whole bunch of, like, other Wizards folks that are kind of incognito. You know, all the brand team typically is there, like the marketing directors, and I think even like the CEO came in, again, because it's local. And I just saw the most, so total tangent at this point. So there's a type of centipede that, like, lives in basements. It's pretty common in North America. It's like, it has, like, lots of long furry legs. You know what I'm talking about?
I guess I know what a centipede is. We have them in Minnesota. I'm not aware of any with furry legs. But I guess I'm not a centipede connoisseur. I don't eat them or keep them as pets or anything.
I don't know, but it was one of the largest I had ever seen just darted across in front of me. So I apologize for my distraction. But the Magic Party, it's one of those events where it's kind of like a golden ticket, right? You get in, you get the CD spoilers first. You get free stuff just for showing up. They'll hand out, like, random stuff to all the people. It was the first place you could buy clan t-shirts. So, like, I bought my Abzan t-shirt, and I'm ready to go because, you know, go Abzan, we're the best clan. Don't even step Mardu, shut up. And you get a chance to talk to Wizards folks. And, like, Sean Main was hanging around. Sean Main's a great designer, really fun guy to hang out with and talk with. I got to play Commander with him a couple days later. I got to hang out with him Gen Con last year. Just a really nice guy. And he had a pocket full of Cogwork Librarians from Conspiracy. And it wasn't a card he designed, but it's just one that he really likes. So he would give out a sign, you know, he would sign Cogwork Librarian and give you a copy if you wanted it. And he was asking questions, like, you know, it's one of the rare opportunities where, you know, designers can look at brand new cards with players that are seeing them for literally the first time and get their, like, gut reactions to them. And they were taking advantage of that. So, you know, different asked me, you know, what did I think of, you know, what was the coolest card that I saw? And what did I think of this? What was the most interesting thing I saw? You know, and I have, like, weird answers because, you know, I think about things really weird and not always in the right way. Like, I thought the new template for the charms was really awesome because it makes it super clear. You get one of these bullet points and it's just super, super spaced out. Like, there's confusion. There's no weird run sentencing going on. It's just choose one and you get a list of three things to choose from. Like, Temur Ascendancy is just, like, screaming, I am going to do really disgusting things in Commander where I'm just going to start chaining four drop creatures and pumping them out. Stuff like that is just, it's one of the opportunities where, like, if you've ever wanted to meet Mark Rosewater or you ever wanted to say thank you or screw you to Aaron Forsythe for something that happened in Magic, that's the place you get to do it. And there's no other real way to guarantee that happening because they're going to be there and it's going to be a good time.
So was there any, as you mentioned during the cons party, that's where we got this huge slug of reviews. Was there any, as they're being revealed at the party, that seemed to have the maybe the most positive or the most negative or just the biggest response from the people there?
I mean, the biggest response was easily the Allied Fetchlands. Just the crowd went berserk because great. Like, a lot of people, you know, like you and I, Tom, we've played Magic for a long time. Maybe off and on, maybe more some years, less other years, you know, depending upon life, but we've never really totally disconnected from the game and walked away.
Yeah, like, we wane a bit, but yeah.
Yeah. We're really the exception. We are the super fans. We are the type of people that make it our goal if we go to PAX to go to this Magic party. And most players aren't like that. Most players, like the average player, and again, this comes from, like, anecdotal stuff that they've shared in articles here and there. So again, I don't have a font of market research based on last quarter's findings that I'm going off of here, but this is just general things that they've shared, is that most Magic players have started in the past year three, you know, 2 years is the average tenure of a Magic player. Most Magic players, like, didn't play Innistrad. Or the average Magic player that you would run into, Innistrad is not where they got in. They got in, like, right after it. Or they came back, or they saw Return to Ravnica, and that was, like, their first thing. So, like, stuff like the Zendikar Fetchlands, like, feel like eons ago. And, like, Onslaught Fetchlands, like, it's a different card frame. Like, it's been over, you know, it's been a very long time since those cards have been printed. you know, in both physical terms and to like Magic player tenure terms. So for a lot of players, like the idea of having access to these lands, having ways to, you know, being able to add them to their modern decks, like, and get them for Commander, and like the most recent printings of the Onslaught fetch lands were Judge Foils.
Mm-hmm.
Like for context, like they were once considered so premium that they were a Judge Foil.
I mean, before this announcement, I mean, if you're flooded the Shrine, usually the blue white one would be the most expensive, was, you know, really about $100.
Yeah, I mean, Polluted Delta was like closing in on 75 or 80, and like the foil, like a foil Japanese was like 400 or 500. I mean, this is like Sky Dollars here. Like Conley can go off about what Sky Dollars are for these cards.
But like, is this like Monopoly money, like Disney dollars, or like Sky Dollars?
Just an expression for like an absurd amount of money. Like, you know, like you need some sort of imaginary Sky Dollars to describe like what, how valuable these cards felt like. But coming back as a staple and standard means they'll be accessible for like, you know, probably similar to the Ravnica Shocklands. Like you'll be able to get them for like 10-ish bucks, you know, 10 to 15. Wanted to put them in the Commander deck, like, and they're like, well, I don't want to spend $40 on just Bloodstained Mire, like the black red one. Well, now you can get it, and it'll be easy. You know, just draft.
Yeah, part of me was scared. I pulled this MTG price time there. It basically aggregate card prices from all the places, but they have a really nice way of bringing the price trend over time, and you can zoom in. So I pulled up September 2nd versus September 4th for the price of Fitzgerald. This is average kind of fair price. Went from $100 down to, this is the Onslaught version, down to roughly about $33. So I do feel bad when we're sitting on these as an investment, but as, just as a player, being at these for $10 a pop for Commander decks or Codex is fantastic.
Yeah, and that's, you know, like I've seen emails and forum threads and discussion threads about, you know, what are the prices of the Onslaught fetch lands? And I think ultimately, like, there are always, like, the collector types that are like, I prefer the first printing or the old card frame or yada yada, whatever.
But that's a Sky Dollar person. I mean, I guess I don't really care what they think. So, okay, so you're saying Onslaught fetch lands coming back, huge response. It maybe that's not a telling good thing for a set if the most popular thing is a card brand. How about any of the new cards?
It's been all over the place. Like, you know, like I've got my personal favorites. So I think Sultai Charm is sweet. Like there were so few wedge colored cards like that actually use the full wedge. That when you go to build like an allied color deck, like you've got two different sets, you've got two different charm cycles to look at. You've got two different blocks to look at where there are allied stuff printed. And for the wedge colors, there wasn't that much. So seeing stuff like Sultai Charm, and just to refresh everyone's memory, I'm going to pull up what Sultai Charm is because it's really sweet. Go ahead.
Yeah, black, green, blue, instant. So very similar terms. It's uncommon. And again, I am with you. I really do like a new template where it basically gives you the bulleted list where you choose one action that has three bullets. Destroy target monocolored creature. Destroy target artifact or enchantment. Or draw two cards and then discard a card. And it just looks so much cleaner when it's, big, like you said, a weird run-on sentence. I can clearly see that these are bullets. I choose one. Feel like there's no questions. Do you feel like mentally, though, they connect with wedges? I feel like, you know, I have an idea for guilds where I have two colors like red, white, red, blue, black. I have a rough what I would expect for those cards to do. I feel like with wedges, they could almost put anything on the arms and I would kind of buy it. I'm not sure what I expect wedges to do, like what my expectations would be for a blue, black, green wedge. Do you feel that, or do you feel you connect and kind of understand what I should be expecting from wedges?
I mean, I think that because wedges have just been given identities, it's a little hard to like feel the connection because it's all new. It's like we're being told this is what this wedge means. We've given it a name, Sultai. We've said it's this color arrangement, and we're going to pull in themes and things that fall within this wedge, and we're going to try to find unique things that call out and make it feel natural. So, like, I look at Sultai Charm, and literally, you just go straight down the list. And it draws from each of the colors. So destroy target monocolored creature can be just a black spell. Destroy target artifact enchantment can be a green spell. And draw two cards, discard one is a blue spell. you can put them all together as an instant, and so you get this card that is almost impossible to cast unless you're dedicated to this wedge. But the upside is you just get so much versatility. You know, in a format like Commander, where you can just randomly nuke somebody's commander at instant speed, or at the end of the turn just draw a card and discard something you want to reanimate, or even just like just randomly blow up, you know, an artifact or enchantment. Like just all of those individual abilities are better than marginal. They're very useful abilities, and they get them all in one card. It's great.
Let me give you a more flavorful maybe wedge example. And that's, I mean, it's the one next, right next on the list. That's Temur Ascendancy. It's a green, blue, red. It's a rare. It says creatures you control have haste, and whenever a creature with power 4 enters the battle under your control, you may draw a card. So this one seems more flavorful. I feel like I'm getting Fires of Yavimana, sort of a greenish vibe that when I play big creatures, I get cards, which is sort of a blue flavor to it.
Yeah,
do you like that? Or are you looking for something way beyond just combining kind of old card abilities?
You know, I think Mark Rosewater will probably talk about it again, but one of the things that goes into design is there are a bunch of ways to make multicolor cards. And Conley can, I'm pretty sure Conley is not a fan of this, but there's this idea of Chinese menu, right? Where you have two or three colors going in. So you choose like, you know, A, B, and C from each, you know, one each from the different list of things those colors can do and kind of roll them together. So Temur's ability is an ability word ferocious, and it cares about when you have something with four or more power. So in this case, it's kind of like a green, kind of like a greenish, reddish ability. You know, haste is definitely like a green, red thing. You know, with Temur Ascendancy, the idea that you get to draw a card, that's something we've seen in Garrick's Pack Leader, which is like a mono green card.
Yeah,
so,
mono green card, yeah.
Like I think Temur Ascendancy is a really good combination of abilities for a really efficient enchantment. Like, it's one that I'm definitely, that's the enchantment that I'm looking to jam in Commander, and I'm going to revisit build, not a Maelstrom Wanderer deck, which did some very gross things, but maybe Riku, and do some like cool, do some weird creature copy type stuff with him. I don't know, just dork around, but it feels like it doesn't feel like it's new, and I get that, but I think the idea that all of this together, saying your creatures have haste, we care about if they're big, and you're going to draw cards as you go, like all together, kind of is the identity that they're giving. You know, that wedge that, you know, they're kind of ferocious. They're in your face. They're going to be attacking you. They're big, they're strong, they're smarter than you think. And I think that's kind of like the Temur flavor thing, you know, and once we've played with it for a while, and then we step away and we see stuff, maybe, you know, maybe when we revisit wedges in like another Commander product or something like that, we'll feel that echo. We'll be like, oh, I get how this fits into the clan, and it's different stuff.
I feel like that's where my expectations are coming. The wedge card and the previous Commander products, and to me they felt fairly, I mean, it was mainly on their cards themselves, but they seemed fairly unique in their crazy abilities, like, you know, Mimeoplasm, they did some funky things.
Yeah, I mean, the Mimeoplasm fits in with you know, with Sidisi Brood Tyrant. That's like the con of the Sultai, because it's like whenever she enters the battlefield or attacks, you start milling cards, and then when creature cards are put into your graveyard from your library, you get zombies. So basically it's like saying it's rewarding you for self-mill, which is a very blue-black thing, a very green-black thing, and it fits in there. But like if you pair her with like the Mimeoplasm, like instead of, like if you make this your commander and you focus on dumping a bunch of stuff in your graveyard and like you're threatening with a bunch of tutus in play, you know, you open up the opportunity to Mimeoplasm awesome stuff out of your graveyard, or to you know, Sepulchre Primordial, everyone else's graveyards and things like that, where it fits, it feels like it fits into the things that those color pairs were already doing. It's just being called something different now.
Yeah, I guess in my mind, what I would say, it seems really interesting versus maybe less interesting. Like I said, sort of the Chinese menu approach would be Lightning Angel. It's a white, red, white, blue. It's a 3/4 flying vigilance haste. Seems fairly, yeah. Flying vigilance haste, you basically have white, blue, and red right in there. Versus, to me, one of my favorite of the commanders that came out of the Commander products was Zedru the Greathearted. It just seemed like it kind of made sense for red, white, blue, but it was such a unique ability where you're getting bonuses from stealing permanents, or I should say giving permanents away. That was fantastic. That seemed like a really unique combination of what I would expect from red, white, and blue combined on one card.
Yeah, I mean, some of that is just general wackiness. Like, you know, if you...
But that's feel like that's what we're getting from these wedges. We're combining, you know, all these crazy enemy colors together. They should be not doing normal things.
Well, there's another set in the block. So I would assume that there may be some wackiness yet to come. And obviously, preview season's not even close to over. We've got a whole other week. So, you know, there's some interesting things coming. But the other thing to keep in mind is when they're designing, like, a Commander product, right, you have a rare opportunity to do stuff that doesn't necessarily fit in any sort of given creative paradigm or any sort of flavorful world universe. Here, you know, it has to connect. It has to feel like these pieces fit together in a way where I get why they're all connected. And that has to be part of it. Like, that's part of what flavorful creative design is meant to do. Is, yeah, we're being introduced to five clans, and five clans with five different wedge three color combinations is a lot of information to process. We're getting six mechanics in the set. You know, morph plus one for each of the clans. So already we're getting more. You know, this is like a Ravnica level set where we're getting all these new mechanics. Plus we're introducing all of these combinations to players. It's the first time they're introducing these color combinations, and they really want them to stick, obviously. You know, so I mean, like, I totally get what you're saying now, Tom. Like, it would be great just to see something really wacky and wild off the wall, and it's like, how does this even, like I don't even, you know, be like a, you know, like a 14-year-old girl on chat, like, I don't even, what?
Yeah, I guess it's tough to say. It's pretty easy to draw comparisons to Ravnica, which in a lot of ways is probably one of the most popular locks of all time. People love Ravnica because I think in general people love gold color cards and seeing interesting mechanics be created. So the expectations are probably painfully high for this set now that we know that we're getting wedges or clans, whatever term we want to use for it now. And now something they're trying to make everybody happy, that's never ever going to happen. They're not the Bee Gees, you know, creating music. They're making a set of Magic cards that appease kitchen table Tom to, you know, hardcore trade players, which they're not looking at art, they're not looking at flavor text, they're looking at, you know, power for cost.
Right. So the thing is there may not be as many like brand new novel things that kind of like trip your Tom trigger, but there are a lot of echoes to things that we've seen before. Like the card Utter End. So it's a two mana and two and black white.
Could have made it a goat card, Adam. It could have been Utter End. UDDER.
I think that would be the unhinged three, the third unset version.
Utter, it doesn't affect the power of the card. it's still exiling target non-land permanents. Give me a goat on there with a big Utter.
I mean, I do collect ass whooping.
I like that.
Which is a donkey that's been obliterated.
Oh, the cards. Okay.
Yeah, the actual.
I thought you were insulting people and just getting straight up ass whoopings.
No, but Utter End is two black white for an instant, and it's just exile target non land permanent. And which if you've played long enough, or you've played Commander or Legacy, you've probably come across the card Vindicate, which is a sorcery that just says destroy target permanent. So we lose the ability to nuke lands because that's not something they do anymore. And they certainly don't do it at three mana, let alone four. Typically you see that at five mana in red. But just the fact that it's four speed.
Demolish and stuff, we still see, I would say, rarely get a four color. But I mean, basically it's pretty vanilla. Four seems to be the lowest cost you're going to get for a straight land kill.
Yeah, I guess I'm just used to seeing it as like the five mana, like blow up a land and get some marginal effect limited trap card, you know, that you don't ever need except for like the one guy that has like Mystifying Maze or whatever in his deck. But it's just, you know, it's one of those things where black and white both have the ability to exile creatures and permanents and all sorts of stuff. So it's just this, you know, very, very simple card. And it's enemy colors, you know, it's not wedge, which is nice because I think the enemy colors are definitely the color pairs that needed the most beefing. I don't know if that makes sense, but allied colors have been hit more often, just incidentally and anecdotally over time in different sets. So I'm really excited to see that the focus seems to be on wedges and enemy color pairs.
Yeah, that seems exciting.
Some of it just echoes to stuff that we've seen before because Utter End is really good.
Well, it's instant, and one extra color's mana to make it an instant and exile seems like a trade. And like I said, I build a new client, so I'm completely cool with that.
Yeah. And that isn't to say that all of the set is focused on this, you know, wedge and enemy color thing. Like you said, like they look to satisfy everyone, and the preview that just came out, this is Thursday, so you probably, you know, we're just seeing this today, but it's my preview from in Command Tower, and it's Clever Impersonator. It's a card that players have been begging for since Planeswalkers came out. They've just been like, let me copy, I want to copy Planeswalkers because I don't get enough value, blah, blah, blah. So it's 2/2 blue for a creature shapeshifter. It's a mythic rare, 0/0. But you may have Clever Impersonator enter the battlefield as a copy of any non-land permanent on the battlefield. So you can copy your own Planeswalker and kind of like chain off, like, use my Planeswalker, play another copy of it, do something with it again. You can copy opponent's Planeswalker. You can copy their ridiculous enchantment. Like, oh, you've got Defense of the Heart. Well, I've got Defense of the Heart. So let's dance. You know, it's one of those cards where, you know, I can't compare it to cards at scale, because you can build intrinsically your deck to kind of abuse the ability to copy almost anything. But it's also a card where if you're just playing a random opponent in multiplayer, having the ability just to like copy like one of the best things on the battlefield is usually pretty good. And in a format where things cost like 6, 7, 8 mana, 4 mana to spend on it is really good.
Well, compare this to Clone. I mean, if you're an Ultra Magic player, you're same converted mana cost, instead of just being 1 blue, it's 2 blue, and now you can, like you said, copy pretty much anything besides a land.
Yeah, and you know, it's mono-colored, so it goes in, you know, 3 different clans, I think. 3 or 2, I don't remember. But it's one of the things where it's like, if you're not into the clan thing, and you're like, whatever, like, I'm not, you know, wedge colors aren't my bag, like, you've got stuff like Clever Impersonator coming, and it's just a really, really, it's one of those chase cards where, like, if you get a foil, just hold it. I mean, trade it to me first, because I'd really like to get a foil copy, and I'd love to make that happen, but hold on to it. It's one of those cards where you will always find a use for it. If you play any sort of commander format, it's great. It may even see play in, like, Vintage, where, like, Phyrexian Metamorph and Phantasmal Image, albeit they cost a little less, this is, like, wildly flexible. Like, it just, you know, it can copy all sorts of random stuff that neither of those two cards can. You know, it's just all around all-star in terms of value. Like, if you're not getting value out of Clever Impersonator, you're not playing it right.
No,
and I think that's going to excite, yeah, I think that's the sort of cards that they have to kind of compare and contrast to all this crazy multicolor stuff they're doing. It's like, you know, if you like multicolor, great, here's a whole bunch of stuff. If you don't, great, here's some really powerful stuff too.
And from your side, just we'll kind of come back to the specific cards, but they have kind of hinted, and now we're saying that kind of the Kamigawa block was a lot about sort of Japanese history and culture. We're getting a lot of here in Cons of Akira is going to be more kind of a Chinese-based culture. Is that something, have you heard, are people excited about this? Are people sort of ambivalent so far that there's sort of some historical underpinnings to this?
It doesn't really feel like Chinese history. Mike Linneman had an article on Gathering Magic recently that basically talked about, you know, from the art that had been spoiled so far, all the different cultural influences. So, like, there's some, like, South Asia, like, Malaysia-type influences. Like, Sultai definitely feels like, you know, jungle, Malaysia, deep, you know, Angkor Wat-type temple.
Yeah, Southeast Asia, deepness, you know, Cambodia, you know, Thailand, and
yeah, and then there's, like, the, you know, the Jeskai and, like, the whole Tibetan monk, like, you know, seeking enlightenment, you know, kind of, like, up in the mountains, up in the air type thing going on. The Mardu feel
correct with, like, killing Tibetan cards if they're a Chinese culture. But never mind, I digress.
The Mardu are definitely, like, feel like the very classical Mongolian riders that just kind of, like, rode across everywhere they could possibly ride and kept moving, and they had a lot of success that way. Like every, you know, the Azban feel almost Byzantine, like, you know, like very like coming from like Middle East, Persia type area with, you know, a very organized structure and a lot of hierarchy and a lot of, you know, like, you know, good bureaucratic handling of resources. You know, that type of stuff, like, they're drawing from these real world influences, and that's something talked about in the panel was, you know, how do you draw on real world influences without making it just feel like you're making the real world in Magic? And it's like, you know, the answer was basically they draw on these things and they get inspiration and then they like iterate on that. So, like, you know, the Mongolian Empire, you know, the the whole Genghis Khan type thing, it evokes that feeling, but obviously they do it in a very, you know, a very different way, and it's taken in a direction that's uniquely magic, and it's kind of a step beyond what you would really think of in the real world. I think that's true of all the places that they're drawing influence from. Like, you know, some of the stuff, like, it's kind of hard, like, you know, when you have a card called Flying Crane Kick, like, which is, like, something I could, like, go learn at, like, a dojo, I guess. I think it's one of those crazy moves. Like, it might actually be, I'm sure it's a real one in, like, Taekwondo or something like that. Like, I don't know enough about it.
Crane Kick was in, I mean, the Karate Kid.
Karate Kid, sure. You know, and, like, that sort of...
There's no movie that's been more accurate to the martial arts than the Karate Kid series. No can, Adam. No can defend.
I no comment. But, so I think there's this weird amalgam of, like, okay, so it's like a flying crane kick, but it's, like, a magic flying crane kick. So, like, it untaps creatures, and, like, they do something really awesome. And that feels kind of very, like, level one. And I think that's probably my biggest argument, not just the argument, I guess that's not the right word, biggest kind of discomfort with kind of the very flavorful approach that's brought into Magic recently is when you're brand new to Magic, that type of card is like, oh, I get it. This is like a magical crane kick and it's fucking sweet. And then like for you and me, we're like, I don't want a crane kick. I want like something like, I want something that's not based on the real world. Like give me like, you know, like lightning style Tau, you know, or something, you know, something that does something like, you know, like call it something different. Like, but by having that kind of evocative real world name, like it makes it connect with people and like, it helps them understand and affiliate like, oh, okay, cool. These are like the cool, like martial arts monks. I get it. And you know, it doesn't excite us, but I think it does a really good role at like introducing people to where Magic is pulling its flavor from, you know, because like every card for that, there's stuff like, you know, Wingmate Rock, which is just like a total magic card of magic cards. You know, I don't know if you saw this the other night, but Wingmate Rock is a 3W for a mythic bird that flies. It's a 3/4. When it attacks, you gain one life for each attacking creature, and it has Raid, which is an ability word, the Mardu ability word that says, if you attack this turn, when Wingmate Rock comes into play, you get another 3/4 flying bird. So it's one of those cards where it's like, this has nothing to do with the real world. It has no real comparative element. It's just a really strong magical card that kind of lights some of our value triggers and makes us excited maybe to play limited and like, wow, this card's going to be a beating if I get to cast on turn five and make 2, 3, 4 birds. But for the new player, they look at it and they're like, you know, they're not going to feel any of those things. They're like, what is this thing doing? You know, it has no creative connection to the real world. It has no way to kind of grok, is a good word to use, like what's going on with it. You know, and I like that there are both cards in there. I just don't like those level zero ones that I think you don't like either.
Yeah, and this is kind of a question from a kind of a flavor design standpoint. Has Wizards ever stated kind of how they decide when they're assigning creature types to make it like an animal versus like an anthropomorphized animal? But my example is I like tribal, so I'm always looking for kind of more cards for key terms. I've always liked elephants. They've been around since Arabian Nights, you know, Beta, Alpha. Is we have Avalanche Tusker. So this is the 2GBR. It's an elephant warrior. So if you look at the art, it's an elephant standing on two legs. He's got arms. One arm is holding an axe. But in the exact same set, it's a different wedge. We have Ivory Tusk Fortress, which is just a straight creature elephant. If you look at the art, it's just a big-ass elephant with a bunch of things and like a little ring hut on top of him. Do you know, like, do you know how they choose if they're going to make it like I'm just a normal elephant or I'm a crazy, you know, walking, talking elephant warrior?
I think they've talked about the process a little bit. Like, it's one of those things where it might seem like, I think there's like, it feels like there should be an easy answer. Like, well, these things mean it's one thing and these things are cat-like, so it's got to be a cat. Like, and I think it's actually much more organic than that. Like, I know that part of the issue that they talk about is like when they get art, right? So developers will talk about like art comes in, I guess, in like two waves. And the thing is once art gets commissioned, right? So once creative has decided, hey, we've got this cool elephant creature, right? So the art goes out and comes back and it's this like gilded badass elephant that like a whole clan, like a whole family rides on. So the card's in development at that point, obviously. So development sees the art. If they want to change that card and make it like, you know, make it like a some tutu instead of like some like massive elephant fatty, they're kind of stuck. Like the art makes them keep it, keep the card the way it is. And like, that was part of the weirdness that had happened with, Dragon's Maze, is that they originally had some of the Maze Runners at Mythic and some of the Maze Runners at Rare. And so they actually swapped the abilities of the, of Voice of Resurgence and Emira, Tandris, trying to remember her last name, where like, she's like this little live elf, but she's like left as like, you know, like a 5'7" or something like that. Like just like this weirdly oversized creature. So that's something I know that limits their ability to like change creature types and change like toughness and size and things like that. But I think it's much more organic. Like creative kind of like designs these creatures. And I think design develops creatures, and development kind of like helps smooth them out across all different rarities and sizes. Cause you don't want a whole bunch of like, you know, elephants and beasts and stuff like that at common, because then it's just like aggro decks can't live, and you know, there's a lot of those things like that. So I really don't know much more than that, and I don't know there's like an official process.
No, it was just kind of funny the small number we had that they had both examples of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a question. I think a similar type of question came out of the panel was, how do you choose like which creatures get represented? It's like they invented a new race for Tarkir, like basically like dogs. And then they repurposed older races that haven't been represented in a while, like djinns and ifrits are in here, and they're kind of like anthropomorphized even more, and they're like basically like a Veldekin type creature type, where like they have like a distinctive look, but like they're very much like just like a humanoid, instead of like some sort of like floating flying demon thing. I think that's one of Magic's strength is from world to world. You know, they kind of get to grab the grab bag of like, what do we want to do and how do we want to do it? So like the goblins on Tarkir look really different from the goblins on like Dominaria, which look different from the goblins on Alara. But they all have that distinctive look where like you they're a goblin and they feel right for like the race, but they obviously have their distinct look of like where they're from.
Yeah, and the goblins on this side look almost more like buggers to me from the, you know, kind of previous blocks. When I look at the art for like Volshanker, it looks like a bogger to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much, very much like a gremlin mischievous type, you know, trickster, creature. So
blind deformed in some ways. It looks like a reject, backup from the movie Chud.
Yeah. Kinda. Yeah. That's actually a really good comparison.
I've seen the movie Chud a lot. I mean, you know, there was a sequel, Chud.
How did I know that you would know that there is a sequel?
Because I watched the original Chud. I probably wore out that copy from our local video update because I saw that, you know, for Auntie, you got two movies for a buck. Look, which you got Chud and something else.
I don't want to know your FAP habits, okay? I really am not interested.
Do you know what Chud stands for in the title? In the movie, it's actually different, but in the title for Chud?
Hit me.
Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers. If you watch the movie, it stands for like a company name, but in the title of the movie, it's Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers. Chud.
Brilliant.
Great movie. Great movie. Well, any other cards, because we're kind of getting towards the end of our time here, any other cards that jumped out that have you especially excited for Commander or just in general? I'm excited for Elements, so two thumbs up there.
I'm just gonna randomly drop my hate for Sagu Mauler. It's 6 mana for a 6/6 trample hexproof, and it has morph, and it unmorphs for 3 in blue green instead of being able to cast for 4 in blue green. I'm so over hexproof. Like, I get why it's a nice mechanic and it does really cool things, because like, I'm gonna play my Mauler, you can't kill it. I'm gonna put my Rancor on it, you can't kill it. I'm gonna attack you and it's gonna hit you really hard and you still can't kill it.
Because it's a not interactive ability, I guess, for a lot of people. It's like, well, it prevents me from doing stuff.
It's one directional. Like, I cast it, I get to do awesome stuff. You get to watch. Lateral. So you know, it just doesn't excite me anymore, and it's just one of those cards where, like, Blue-Green is already a very powerful combination commander. Like, obviously, Blue-Green is going to get some tools and, like, the wedge color block. I get it. Fine. But do they really need, like, you know, like, an easy finisher? Like, you know, like, you have to cast a Wrath. Like, there's just no real other way around dealing with one of these guys.
I could block it with my gigantic Ivory Tusk Fortress. 5/7.
Sure.
The elephant can beat your Mauler. It even costs less. Yeah, damn. That's what an elephant right there. I've just Fortis. You're my card of the show.
One card that kind of has me excited is Ugin's Nexus. And it's one of those cards that it feels kind of like a null rod, right? It does nothing. No, it does nothing. Ugin's Nexus, if you haven't seen it, was one of the cards they shared at the world building panel. It's 5 mana for a legendary artifact. It's a mythic rare. And it has two lines of rules text on it. If a player would begin an extra turn, that player skips that turn instead. So everybody who likes to take extra turns in the 5-player game who are already waiting like 10 minutes to take another turn, screw off. Piss off. Go away. Its second line is, if Ugin's Nexus would be put into a graveyard from the battlefield, instead exile it and take an extra turn after this one. And so it's, you know, it's one of those Johnny, like, you can build around it. Like, obviously, like, something like, Trademark It, that was the artifact that has, like, lets you sacrifice an artifact to get some ability to, like, draw a card or something.
Although it was like, what, 4 colorless and a bunch of different, wasn't it Trading Post.
Trading Post. So like Trading Post is like leaving Standard just as this card is coming in. So like that's like one obvious combo, but it's like one of those cards where I think it's a general upside in Commander. Like if you don't know what to put in your deck and you just want something that'll like keep the game moving, Ugin's Nexus is a good one, because anybody who's thinking about like casting like Planar Cleansing or some sort of like destroy all, like Chroma's Vengeance, like anything that just destroys all creatures and artifacts, well, this is going to make them rethink it because they're giving you an extra turn when they do that. It's the sort of card where like I can drop it on turn 5, and even if it never dies, the fact that nobody else is taking extra turns while we go makes me feel good.
It also takes balls to spend 5 mana on a card like you said. It literally does nothing.
Right. It occupies this really interesting spot. Yeah, and like if you have ways of abusing it, as people naturally will, like this feels like Arcum Dagson fuel. Like, I'm going to tutor up my Ugin's Nexus and untap my Arcum Dagson. Look, I'm going to sacrifice it and take an extra turn after this one and get some other dumb artifact out. Like, it obviously falls right into some of the combos that are already out there. But for like a generic deck or like something like Shattergang Brothers, there's a commander that's like really interesting. It, you know, I can make other people sacrifice stuff by sacrificing my stuff. Well, this is one of those things where like you've got Shattergang Brothers out, you throw down Ugin's Nexus, and you've got the mana up. Like I think 2 and a red is the artifact. One sacrifice an artifact, everybody sacks an artifact. Like that can do some work. Like I'm going to take an extra turn, and you're going to sacrifice your Darksteel plate. Like that feels like a win.
All right, and basically, I want to make sure we get to the emails. We actually got a bunch of emails since our last podcast.
Nice.
Just to let people know, we are not completely ignoring that there was a huge announcement under the article named Metamorphosis from Marcus Water and the Mothership that they're changing how we're doing blocks. So after the block for Constantark here, we're going to 2-set blocks with no core sets, a lot of other crazy changes. I want to save it, though, because Conley, when we were emailing back, he said he had a lot of thoughts on this. I wanted to save it so you could really jump into it. Because I'm curious, is because as a casual player, I almost didn't care. I know some people were just losing it when this came out. For myself, as long as I'm getting new card sets, it doesn't really matter the pattern, or since I don't pay attention to blocks or really play Standard where I need to care what sets are legal, to me, I didn't care. So it was interesting to have such a huge announcement that were probably a big part of the player population was the biggest thing ever. Then the other half didn't really matter. From your side, then, is this one that you cared about or didn't care about when this came out? We won't go into too much detail. I was just kind of curious your initial thoughts.
I mean, I'm excited because moving away from a reprint heavy set into, you know, constantly designing new creative, like it excites me because it, because of the faster iteration, it lets them be a little more aggressive with reprints because they go away faster. So I think we'll see more things like fetch lands down the road because they'll be around for a shorter period of time, so we'll have more opportunities to you know, alternate between fetch lands and shock lands. Like, I doubt they'll ever exist together for any get long period of time, because that's modern. But just the fact that they're going to do more creative straight up and not like this kind of weird amalgam of world building, kind of like, let's pull themes from every plane, or like, let's create like a generic plane to kind of have a theme on, like Magic 2014 was, and like Magic 2015 was. I'm excited for what opportunities that opens up, but I think in terms of being like a player of the format, like, that's something that I definitely would let Conley speak to.
So that's something, well, again, Conley should be back on the next episode. I know we promised every time, but he should be back, and I wanted to save that fairly juicy apple for him. The last thing I want to say about what we know of Khazad Tarkir so far is, I kind of joked about prowess being sort of a sexual innuendo. I will say keyword ability. Give me an even better one, and that's Outlast. So, Adam, I can actually now make a complete sexual connotation innuendo deck featuring prowess and Outlast to outlast my opponent. I was kind of excited about that.
I mean, why do you think I'm Abzan?
So, yeah. This set has it for everybody, from the freaks to the geeks. All right, emails, Adam. Do you want to go back? I want to read our most recent one. This is one of the hotter emails we've ever gotten, even including my Monday Night Magic days. I'm not going to say the person's name, just in case. The initials are KM. It just, subject is "Hello, lovely." The email says, "I love you," period. And then the signature is "Love, Suvington J. Spillman." So, Suvington, I appreciate it. I kind of made my day this morning to get a random love email.
I'm not entirely sure it's not just spam email.
The only reason I know it's not, because I have gotten emails from this person before, from Susan J. Spielman, and it's actual Mac questionnaires in the past. We're going back to Monday Magic days, but this is actually not spam, which made it cooler but almost creepier too at the same time.
It's very intense. I appreciate that. I have to assume that the U is plural, because it speaks to all of us, unless they know that you're like the email guy and it's only for you. In which case, I kind of feel like a little bit of jealousy. Like, why do you have a creeper? I don't.
Yeah, it doesn't say it. You could be your creeper. I'm not going to hog him.
I think it's everybody's. I think he loves the cast and what we do, and he just couldn't contain it anymore. He's just, "Hello, lovely. I love you."
Yes, yeah, please. You just have to share it.
So I'm looking at the email. It looks like there are two different people that sent sent emails about chairs, because you and your damn chair.
We had two great ones. We had a bunch of very good recommendations on Twitter too. But yeah, two emails, and they both were fantastic. So you pick one, and I'll take the other.
I'll take the top one. So one came in from initials KT. And it was just...
Kai has emailed in before, so that's...
Yeah, the original art, Nicol Bolas, is sitting on a chair reading a book, which just seems like the best badass to throw in the chair. Like, you want a 7-7? You got a 7-7.
And it's a $5 commander. So there you... That opens up so you can really have full access to all the art.
Nicol Bolas is...
God, I'm sorry, yeah, never mind. Yes. I was thinking five colors. Damn it. But still, you can really get access.
Let me look up a target talk. You go ahead and read the second one.
Yeah. So yeah, Kai, I think that was a fantastic, because that is one of probably the original classic pictures where it's clearly a very old engine dragon sitting in a chair reading a book. And then Ant, Testral, one of the other, I guess, want to say authors, writers for Gathering Magic, found, I think this may have been the initial Reddit thread read to get the idea for this deck, and it just says, Ant is, if you. Dudes sitting on chairs, so it's good to speak. If you want up on creatures, and so here you go, bone up, Adam. It's a real thing. If you want to bone up on creatures, a magic thing in chairs, this person went through and basically scoured the artwork for almost every match ever made and made an entire list of all the cards that appear to be sitting in chairs, and even broke it down by, I guess, sort of the type of chair. I'm pulling up the thread. So you have sitting in chairs, thrones. Then they have standing in front of chairs and thrones, sitting on the ground, sitting in a boat. This one has water elemental. That one was a fantastic find. Laying suggestively in a chair or bed. my personal favorite, this is Hellcarver Demon under the subheading of laying suggestively on a pile of corpses. And then a bunch of commanders, like it just says non-Orlo colors, like Katie Sabbath, Lovisa Koldai, and Nismivit. But yeah, the winning is the laying suggestively on a pile of corpses. So this is an amazing list. It was done about 10 months ago of basically does my job for me, be able to go through and make my commander deck of things sitting on chairs. So,
Tom, the commander that you want is a Togatog, because he is sitting in the Atog throne, and he's really? A five-color commander. Yeah, I just looked up the art. He is clearly sitting in a chair, because I can see, like, the armrest, and his leg is, like, you know, extended and bent, like he's sitting in a chair. He's got, like, a staff in his, like, left hand.
I pulled up the art. You are 100%. He is clearly sitting in a chair.
That has to be your commander.
All right, so dudes in chairs, a Togatog commander, and then I can put whatever just stinky jank in this deck to say I'm good. And I have to put in Hellcarver Demon of sitting on a pile of corpses.
Suggestively laying on a pile of corpses.
So, Ant, thank you. That was a fantastic resource for helping make this deck.
We got another swag email. This is from Jeremy. It looks sweet. It says, I got these dice from a friend when I started playing Magic around 95. I took these to GP Chicago this year to see if any of the dealers had any idea on the value for them. No one had ever seen them before. Needless to say, I wouldn't trade or sell these for anything. Oh, what a tease! Oh, man, what a tease! So I pull these dice up, and they look like... It looks like they're D10s where the 10 or the 1.
Or the 10, or basically, or like the 100 versus 10.
Or the 10 or the 10 or the 100 is a mana symbol. And it doesn't look like... So I'm looking at these, and it looks like these may have been produced unlicensed.
It's hard to say, because the thing that I always look at is like the white mana symbol, just because that has changed the most over time. And it feels like it has the newer appearance white symbol to me. So it's hard to imagine that would have been what they looked like in 95. That's what I would consider the old-looking white mana symbol.
It does, but like the symbols look a little off. Like the white mana symbol, like the center circle looks like a little large. Like I feel like it should be a little smaller with like a ring around it. The swamp skull definitely doesn't have like the distinctive crack. Like Magic has like a, you know, like that distinctive crack, like I think over like the right orbital. Like when you see it, like it looks really distinctive for a skull. Because skulls are like a dime a dozen. Yeah, it's like it's different. Like the blue mana symbol looks like a little stretched. Like the bottom of the droplet's like a little big and wide. So like it wouldn't surprise me if these were produced unlicensed or like kind of like under the radar, or you know, because there's like a wild heyday where like people just would make and sell anything and you know, catch up with them later.
They look nice though. They look really nice.
Yeah, it's like this is definitely something where like if I could trade for it and use it for commander, like I wouldn't a heartbeat. So, Jeremy, you know, good for you for holding on to them, but also, like, man, screw you. Like, those are awesome.
He takes good care of his dice. I mean, they look, I mean, clearly they've been used and getting out of trash. So, Jeremy takes good care of his stuff.
Yeah. Like, show those off to your friends and be like, what? I got better dice than you. Just do it. It's amazing.
All right, Adam, I'm going to hit you. We have, and this is an actual question for help, which this may not have been the best podcast to email into, but we have one from JT. Returning player needs help. Says, hello, sirs. I used to play Magic when I was a kid, when Fallen Empires were new, but only played with friends. So I would say this is similar maybe to a lot of people around that time frame. I took a long break and returned last year with the release of Gatecrash. I learned of FNM and went to a few before my work no longer allow me to get to my local game store in time to play. That's a whole different topic we can talk about. That is basically the timing of FNMs and their 5:30 start time makes it really hard for a lot of work schedules to make it. I'm taking another break due to work, and I'm now returning again with this new block. I'm assuming he's talking about cons, and need help on getting better. What can I do to get better at building decks? I'm going to the pre-release of cons and don't want to get destroyed. Says I'm enjoying the podcast. Keep it up.
Okay, so there's a couple things going on here. So just a quick aside about FNM start times. So if you're a store owner, you're in a really tough position because your target audience for FNM, like these are people that instead of doing, you know, anything else on a Friday night, they're going to come to your store and pay money to play Magic. So to fill that, you know, typically you want to make it accessible to as many people as possible. So like if you started at like 7 o'clock, like you give everybody who works like a full-time job time to get off and get to the store, you totally alienate, you know, anybody who's like high school or college aged. Cause they could theoretically start at like 5 o'clock, 5:30, finish by like 10 and still like go home and play games with their friends or go out and have fun. And if you start too early, you know, there's that, I can't get to the store in time thing, which is definitely real. And I totally get that because there are tons of stores I would like to go to on Friday, but you know, I'm not going to drive an hour in traffic to get there for 2 hours of fun. So that sucks. And I don't know if there's a good solution for that, but if you want to go to a pre-release and you don't want to get destroyed, the three things I would easily recommend. First, look up the podcast Limited Resources. It's hosted by Marshall Sutcliffe. He and Brian Wong, right now it's gone to two other co-hosts, but Marshall has really carved himself out as a limited specialist. He does a great job breaking down the descriptions of different archetypes and types of cards. They always do like a common and uncommon rare set review. So right up leading up to the pre-release, they will talk about all the cards and they'll talk about what the limited format looks like and give you a lot of context to understand going in, you know, at face value, what do these cards look like? What is it? How is it going to feel? The second thing is to start reading about limited. And again, I'm focusing solely on the question, how do I not get destroyed at a pre-release? Well, you've got to get up to speed on the principles of limited. So Tuesday, Marshall writes a column on Daily MTG called Limited Information. It basically breaks down and explains limited principles. You know, it talks about the new cards right now because it's spoiler season. And it really kind of does a good job giving up the speed. If you go back to the beginning of Marshall's run about a year ago on limited information, you can very quickly kind of get caught up on what limited is really about, how the new design paradigm kind of fits into it, and what goes on with that. And then Fridays on Gathering Magic, I think quietly every Friday there's a very solid limited column written by Jacob Van Loonen, and he is he's a fellow coverage guy, so he does coverage at Grand Prix, and he's kind of known for some of his brewing and decklists. But he actually won a two-headed giant Pro Tour with a friend of his, and they drafted. I believe it was limited. It was like Future Sight Limited, so it was Future Sight block, and they drafted like a Poison Sliver deck, and they totally took an archetype.
One of the Sliver Kids.
Yeah, he was one of the Sliver Kids, and it was totally. It basically broke the two-headed giant format for the Pro Tour in this limited format. And so he has a really rich history of coming at the format, and because he's been writing for so long and doing coverage, he has a really good way of bridging that gap between, you know, this is the zero level concept. What does that really mean for me? Like okay, I get there's card advantage, but what does that really do? What do I do with it? And it's kind of that like additional half step where if you're reading Marshall and then on Tuesday and you're reading JVL on Friday, you're going to get kind of like a holistic like I'm getting new concepts and I'm getting what I need to be doing with them. And obviously it's a ton of information. It's definitely a skill. And that's my third thing is I would just recommend trying to find a group to draft with. Like even if you know it's not the format that you're going to play, like obviously you can't draft cons of Tarkir yet. But just playing more limited Magic is going to help attune your card sense. And what I mean by that is evaluation abilities, like the ability to begin pulling a deck together and going, what does my deck need? You know, if you've got 8 2 drops and 3 3 drops, your deck's going to have some problems compared to a deck that maybe has 6 2 drops and 5 3 drops. You know, the ability to build out a good curve, the ability to see the synergy between different cards, those are things that really only come from experience. And whether it's on Magic Online or it's with buddies, like if you get to the card store late, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple other guys that would be interested in doing a draft. So if you can get your hands on enough product and even if it's unsanctioned, like just drafting with 6 players, you know, a team draft, getting that type of draft play feedback loop going is going to give you opportunities to grow as a player. And so I think those three things in conjunction can set you up to have a pre-release you at least feel prepared for. Because again, with Magic, like you can be one of the best players on the planet, and you could be one of the best limited players too, and you can just run into just random mana screw and good luck on opponents. So I think it would be unfortunate if you went to the pre-release and said, I'm going to do well. But I think in terms of not getting destroyed, building those basics and really committing yourself to at least growing your limited understanding gives you a good opportunity to at least win some games at a pre-release, and I think you'll have a good time.
Yeah, I would just add that two other maybe resources for really maybe early starting just general deck building is in the newest Duels of the Planeswalkers 2015 is, even though it's not the entire card pool, it actually has a fairly impressive sized card pool where they, if you unlock the full game, which I can't remember if it's $20 or $30, it does give a slew, a bunch of example, kind of, you know, probably good tier two constructed decks. You can kind of see what different card combinations are for, like red, green, black, blue. You know, what are the powers of those colors? How do they interact? You know, what you should be looking for. Then you also have an option to, you know, freewheel and build your own constructed decks. And it's nice because it does have some built-in auto-suggesting features and also helps you build your land base. Because it doesn't matter as much maybe in limited, but if you start getting it constructed, sometimes being your mana base is incredibly hard. And this can start to kind of give you an ability of how to judge, well, given how many mana symbols I have, how many of types of each colored mana source should I have. So I think Duels of Planeswalkers 2015 was really nice. It also just lets you play a bunch of, you can play a giant, you can play more of a limited form, but it does let you play just a buttload of constructed games and kind of see what works, what doesn't for your playstyle. And maybe also kind of see what, if you're really new back to the game, kind of colors, probably what they do in some ways are then way back in Fallen Empire. So you may find that you might gravitate towards different color combinations than you did back. And then try out different types and see what you like. The second would be kind of for you, and looking more to limited side, is I've always had fun and really lets me sort of do my first pass of learning a limited set as I like. I'm not sure if it's available on all platforms. I use the iOS one. It's called Deck Drafter. It's fairly cheap. It's like $2.99 a set. It's a way of kind of simulating, I guess, you know, as legal as possible, simulating drafts and sealed pools with real cards. And actually, each time he hires, I don't know how well-known pros are, but pros who write up basically an evaluation of each card. And for me, it's a really nice way to kind of seize a pack. And then you can also see what, in that given rating, which card was probably the best to pick. Really lets you learn, like, boy, what I initially thought was a really good card was just a big steaming pile. And in limited times of what seems to be a weaker card might actually be a really good pick. So those two, for me, have come a really base level because I literally do nothing about limited for quite a while. I feel like those get a little bit more up to speed pretty quickly. And without maybe necessarily a huge cost, I felt really scared to just jump into drafting with random people with product because it was kind of expensive. At least here I felt I had some base knowledge for a fairly low cost that when I started playing with real product where I'm, you know, throwing $10, $20 of product into this, I feel like at least a somewhat decent chance. I know I wasn't going to win, wasn't playing to win. But at least I wouldn't embarrass myself. So that's why I would add to it. Because I feel like I was in his shoe limited not that long ago.
Yeah, I would kind of argue a little differently. Like I can understand the appeal and benefits of that, Tom. But I feel really strongly like if you're getting hung up on your ego of I'm learning and I don't want to feel bad that I'm learning, you're gonna have a real learning. Like really the best way to grow, whether it's building decks or winning games, is actually just playing Magic. And so like if you want to get better at building decks, try building decks and playing with them. They're going to fail. They're going to fail a lot. And that's something you're going to have to get used to because a big part of Magic is losing. And that's not just me kind of throwing out some fluffiness. It's like it's one of the major skills that the top level players have is like they can have a totally awful Pro Tour. And it's like, well, I just lost some games of Magic and that happens. Like they don't get hung up on the idea that because I lost a few games of Magic, I'm not a worthy player. I'm not a good player. It's more about, am I learning from things that I can learn from? And am I accepting the things that are outside my control? Like you can't control that your opponent drew exactly the right sequence of cards to get you, but you can control the sequence of cards that you play and you had to work with that could build you to a position that forced your opponent to have exactly the cards they needed. Otherwise they would have lost. Like, you know, that's the thing to look at. So like, even if you're scared or terrified, if you can find players that want to draft, or like, even if you buy your own box or you have your own box and say, hey, look, you know, I want to practice drafting. Let's draft and I'll just keep the rares, or I can trade, you know, you can trade for any rares that I open that you need for decks or whatever. One good thing is if you have a buddy that plays Magic, I actually really enjoy building sealed decks. And that's what I would do with a good friend of mine over lunch is we would build sealed decks. We would play against each other. And, you know, it was a really good low impact way, low risk way of getting in, cracking some packs, building a deck, playing without necessarily having that whole weight of, I got five people, you know, looking at me, or I got my teammates counting on me to win. But just playing more Magic, whether it's limited or constructed, is going to help you at both sides.
Yeah, I guess I would agree about 99%, where I just would feel like you would want some, you know, base of knowledge so that, like you said, when you are losing, you know, that you can learn from that. Because if you really went in pretty cold without much knowledge, you might be losing and not really know why or how to improve from those experiences.
That's fair. Yeah, having a janky deck,
you'd be like, I know it's a bad deck, but, you know, how is it bad? Why am I losing every game?
Yeah, I mean, having people to bounce ideas off of or just ask questions from after you play or during you play, that's always a really good benefit. You know, that's somebody that you have to trust, and sometimes it's hard, and sometimes they're not there, and you really have to listen to a lot of, you know, why would you play a card like that, you know, five times to get, I can see why you would play that card, but have you considered this instead? Because your deck looks like it's doing that. And the type of quality feedback that you might really want. Yeah. It is tough.
Yeah, and that might be maybe the biggest challenge of this whole thing is we spend a lot of time talking about how to, you know, resource, learn more about the game, you know, mission limited resources, you know, Magic Arena Online. But probably the biggest challenge, especially if you're kind of a newer adult gamer, is finding a local game store or a gaming group that you can get into. Because if you're new to this and you walk into a store and there's a lot of 15-year-olds that are kind of sneering at you and you want to punch them in the throat, that's hard. I think that's maybe why we lose so many Magic players. It sometimes can be tough to break into that culture.
Oh, man, that is a whole podcast episode into itself.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm just that's something just me as an adult, even though I guess I have contacts from podcasting. But when you just show up at a local game store, you know, you can only take so many stink eyes. So you want to start stabbing people. And because, yeah, you said we could spend an entire podcast talking about kind of this is the same for a lot of, I don't know if you want to call geek culture, be it video games. There's been a lot of, you know, incredibly crude, gross examples of kind of the misogyny in video games over about the last month. And you could probably apply a lot of these same things to Magic, just because it's probably a fairly similar base group that enjoys, I don't know, both hobbies. So it can be, I'm talking this way, I guess, an adult male perspective. I can't potentially imagine trying to break in if you were like a really young male, young female, you know, we podcasters who are transgender. It seems like it'd be incredibly challenging sometimes just to get into the culture and find a group that you gel with and have fun with. Because it really only takes one or two bad experiences and that person is kind of done.
We'll talk about that on another episode. Yeah. That is a very, very big topic, but
you start with MGO. It only took a couple of backers to be like, yeah, never again.
So JT, I don't know, you know, there is no easy divine answer that we can just hand you and say, do this and you'll do great. But I hope that we've maybe reinforced some maybe things that you've seen or thought of already and kind of encouraged you to go off and do the things that you want to do. And I hope you keep enjoying Magic.
Yeah, because it should be, hopefully it should be fun. Because the whole grinder scene kind of terrifies me when people feel like are playing this game and hating every minute of it. I want things sitting in chairs. And a Tog-a-Tog will give me that.
I have assigned a Tog-a-Tog. Because it's Ron Spears. So
yep.
I built a deck with a Tog-a-Tog already, and it wasn't my cup of tea. If you want it, I'll send it to you, Tom.
I would love it. He is the perfect. I'm assuming he. I'm going to be misogynistic right here. But I'm going to say he looks like the great commander for the sitting in the chairs deck. So sure. I sold most of my cards, but I will find something to send back that's hopefully Magic related.
All right. So yeah, so I think that's it for this week. I mean, Constant Hercure spoilers are happening. They're going to keep happening this week. You know, probably Friday we'll have the whole spoiler. You know, the full card image gallery will be filled up. So I'm excited to see like a lot of the commons, like Raid seems really sweet for common for my cube. Uncommon has a lot of like power dense multicolored cards. And then like the monocolored cards seem to be getting pulled up with them. We've got mythic rares that are just absurd already. So I am super excited. I can't wait to see how this all comes together.
So Adam, if people wanted to contact you or the show, what sort of electronic and or social media networks could they use?
Well, if you want to yell at Tom and I for being idiots, you can email us anytime at mtgpotpourri at gatheringmagic.com.
Exactly. You can also just by itself rules out the real idiots because they're not going to spell that right.
I mean, I think that's a net positive for us. And if exactly. you can't I wait, if you can't wait for email, like email just too much, I need to yell at you now. Just ping us on Twitter at MDGPotpourri. You'll be able to yell right at us. Tom monitors it pretty closely, so if you really want to yell at Tom, that's a good way to do it. If you want to yell at me because I'm a stick in the mud killing Tom's fun, I'm the_Stibbs on Twitter. And you can hit me up at Gathering Magic, of course, at stibbs@gatheringmagic.com. You can also email me for Command Tower. So if you read the Thursday column Command Tower on the Magic the Gathering website, commandtowerstibbs@gmail.com. All three of those channels will get my attention.
Yeah, I'm a nobody, so all I have is my MTG Potpourri email address, or at Twitter I am PSG Reader. And that's all I got for you. No articles, no VIP parties, no punch and bear tokens. Just me and diapers, baby. Lots of diapers.
Hey, I got a lot of diapers too. It's a hard life.
I know you understand, but I have cool stuff on the side.
If you want to make fun of Conley for not being on the podcast for the last two episodes, you can hit him on Twitter at Conley81.
Yeah, apparently, I mean, it seems like life always kind of craps on his parade, but it sounds like it's been crapping exceptionally more than usual. Kind of from his Facebook post. Sounds like a lot of, I'm not sure what real life tilting really means, but apparently that's been happening.
I mean, I think real life tilting is like when like you lean to one side and like walk on an angle. I mean, that seems like real life tilting to me.
And it could also be a stroke or vestibulitis as well.
It could be inner ear infection, or some sort of issue with equilibrium balance that could cause you to have real life tilt.
What are the kind of balances do you have? Your ethical moral compass balance.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sociopathology. I mean, that is a literally tilted, tilted emotional experience of the world.
Yeah, so like for me, MTGO, that definitely tilted my bounce. Before I could stab and find those people in real life, I probably would. But I feel okay because they would have deserved it for the horrible, horrible things that they would say to me through the chat window.
Yeah, block is my favorite.
Yeah, that's the only thing that makes me worry about streaming. I'm just afraid that I'm not sure how you would just block all the vitriolic hate that comes through the chat windows MTGO. But that's
quickly,
its own.
Quickly and efficiently.
Yes.
That's how I would block it.
So everybody, thank you. We're kind of getting back on the horse here a little bit. We're finding some ways to make sure that we can make time to podcast. Everybody's got work, Pro Tours, Grand Prix, kids, jobs, you know, the whole nine yards. We're talking about adult gamers, but we're doing pretty well. We're back on the horse, and hopefully you enjoy it and tune in next time for another. The next one is probably going to be the most special MTG Potpourri ever. So make sure to tune in for the next
absolutely
one.
Absolutely the most special.
Mm-hmm. Guaranteed. So Adam, thank you very much. And again, I'm Tom, and have a good week. Oh my God, a cat just barfed. Nice work.
Can you please leave the end of that in?
Yeah, no, Smush just came in just, I don't know, hacked up something. Yeah, it almost looked, you know what the flying spaghetti monster, kind of, I don't know if you want to call it the fake religion. You know what that thing looks like?
Yeah, it's the spoof religion. It's like, I don't believe in things because this is how I perceive it. They're a literal flying spaghetti monster that touched the world with a noodly appendage.
That's what it looks, apparently the flying spaghetti monster had touched Smush with his noodly appendage and he then coughed up a baby one. Which is always a little scary with cats, is that either meant they actually ate noodles or it could be worms. So that is the disturbing thing. So you have to wait to see if that moves or not.
Fantastic.
There we go. There's your bet moment of the day. I wish the colonists here, because this would just be another dead silence time. And it's better when there's three people full of dead silence.
He would be like, well, I've got to go.
I'm done.
I'm done.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much and have a good one.